You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم امر الله سبحانه الا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام خالط الناس مخالطة إن متم معها بكوا عليكم وإن عشتم حنوا إليكم.
Imam Ali, peace be upon him, said, "Meet people in such a manner that if you die, they should weep for you, and if you live, they should long for you."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio. The program is To My Brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam. Dear friends, when talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali, alayhi salam, of course we find that the persona of Imam Ali is something which has transcended and surpassed time and age. We find that the things that Imam Ali said and the behaviors and the actions of Imam Ali alayhi salam are truly a role model for every single age, even in today's present day. In one of Imam Ali alayhi salam's sermons, we find that Imam Ali talks about individuals who sit for the dispensation of justice among the people. Now, he is talking about judges, whether they are religious judges or a-religious judges. But in general, he is talking about those people who sit for the dispensation of justice among people but are not fit for it. Now, each and every single one of us, in one way or the other, is such that we do dispense justice. We don't necessarily have to be a judge in a court of law to be dispensing justice. But in our own little way, in our very different and unique positions of power in our lives, whether it's something as simple as being a older brother and sister or a mother and father, or for example, an individual who has a little bit more power, such as somebody who is the boss in the office, in one way or the other, we are dispensing justice. Here, Imam Ali talks about the qualities of individuals who are dispensing justice, but are not fit for it. It is quite scary, but Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "Among all the people, the most detested before Allah are two people. One of them is one who is devoted to their own self," meaning they only care about themselves, they only care about their own benefit, they only care about their own loss. They are an individual who is selfish. And then Imam Ali continues and he says, "So this individual who is devoted to their own self is deviated from the true path, and they love to speak foul innovations, inviting towards the wrong path." Dear friends, we must be very careful in our different positions of power when we are dispensing justice among the people to make sure that we are not devoted to ourselves. The justice that we are meting out to the people is not based upon our own selfish requirements or our own selfish needs or our own selfish desires and wants. Because this kind of an individual who dispenses justice in whatever position they are in, and they are devoted to their self, then they will be deviated from the true path. they will have gone astray from the true path, and they will begin to invite towards the wrong path. So not only will such an individual lead to their own destruction, but they will also lead to the destruction of other people. So we must be very careful when dispensing and meting out justice among the people. Another profound and thought-provoking lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of iRib English Radio, the program To My Brother. I'm Atta, the producer of this program, and at this moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم فاستجب دعائي واقبل ثنائي واجمع بيني وبين
O Allah, give favorable answer to my prayer. Acknowledge the praise I sign in worship. Let there be peace and harmony between me and my friends for the sake of Muhammad, Ali, Fatima, Al-Hassan, and Al-Hussein. Verily, thou art my benefactor who provides with bounties, the aim of my desires, the ultimate destination of my hopes in my future life and during this short life. Thou art my God, my master and my Lord. Welcome my friends, keep our enemies away from us. To save us from the evil mischief, divert their attention. Let the true world come out in the open, supreme and dominant. Refute and condemn the folly, rendered contemptible. Verily, thou art able to do all things.
إنك على كل شيء
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
I just would like to share with you one sentiment or the feeling of a lady who was among the followers of Ahlul Bayt. And this is a lady who is known as Sauda bint Ammara bin al-Ashtar al-Hamdaniya. And she was from the family which believed in Amir al-Mu'mineen, from the Hamdaniya Yemeni family and the tribe. And she was a poetess in her own right. She was talented in composing poetry. And in the Battle of Siffin, interestingly, she was there with her brother. And she played her part in composing lines in order to encourage. Primarily, what we see is that she is addressing her own brother who was there in the army of Amir al-Mu'mineen, you know, to move forward and fight for the cause of Ali. It seems that she was also a very courageous lady. When we see in history, after the Shahadat of Amir al-Mu'mineen, when Muawiyah comes to power, a situation happened in their area in Yemen that the governor sent there was a very cruel person, Ibn Artat, and the people of the tribe basically wanted to send a complaint to Muawiyah about this officer. But they couldn't find anyone more courageous and willing to go and represent them but this lady by the name of Sauda. And so she accepted this task. She went all the way to Damascus and sought the audience with Muawiyah. She was given the permission to go in. But before she comes in, Muawiyah was briefed about her. And of course, he also knew about the lines of poetry that she had against Muawiyah and her and his family. Where after, you know, coming in, after salam and the normal, you know, discussion after greetings, Muawiyah started reciting the lines of poetry that she had composed. And she says, "Aren't you the one who said this? Shammir ka fa'li abika yabna ammar yawma ta'ani wa multaqal aqran." Where she says, addressing her brother, she says, "Get ready like your father, O son of Ammara, on the day of fight when champions meet. وانصر عليا والحسين ورحته واقصد لهند وابنها بهوان." Support Ali and Hussein and his family and target Hind, the mother of Muawiyah, and her son with disgrace. إن الإمام أخ النبي محمد علم الهدى ومنارة الإيمان. Because the Imam, the true Imam, is the brother of the Prophet Muhammad, who is the sign, the Imam, who is the sign of guidance and the minara, the minaret of Iman. فَقُدِ الْجُيُوشِ وَسِرْ أَمَامَ لِوَائِهِ. So therefore, O my brother, lead the armies of Ali and go ahead of his flag. قُدُمًا بِعَبْيَزِ صَارِمٍ وَسِنَانٍ. March forward with shining sword and arrows.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Gaza was flashed bright by explosions as Israeli artillery and other weapons targeted what they say were weapons factories and rocket launch sites belonging to the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. Following the latest round of aggression initiated by the Israeli military, an aerial duel was also held as rockets were fired from Gaza towards Israel, some intercepted by the Israeli Iron Dome anti-missile system, yet many penetrated deep inside Israel, reaching as far as Tel Aviv. Earlier, in a televised address, the Israeli Prime Minister said the regime had zero tolerance for attacks from Gaza and that isn't interested in a wider conflict in Gaza but will not shy away from one either. Israel has labeled the latest round of aggression as a preemptive operation. It says it aimed to thwart alleged planned rocket attacks by the Islamic Jihad. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad called the initial Israeli bombardment a declaration of war, firing a barrage of at least 100 rockets into southern Israel. Around 13 people were taken to the hospital with minor injuries. Some reports have, however, indicated that many Israelis were killed in the retaliatory attacks. In response to the Israeli aggression, the Al-Quds brigades launched attacks on cities across the occupied territories. Hamas also announced its support for the Islamic Jihad and said it would respond to the strikes. Israel claims it targets military sites, but similar to all other attacks by the regime, civilians seem to be on the receiving end of the rockets.
Definitely, this is a war crime. It's a war crime in itself. The bombing in itself is a war crime. The siege of Gaza and the blockade for 15 years is a war crime. The starving people, cutting off the electricity and cutting off the water supply and cutting off the ability for Palestinians to import much necessary food and building supplies and medicine and allow people to leave and come back is a war crime in itself. This is not acceptable. And that's one thing. The second aspect of it is that the fact that Israel has claimed and actually publicly announced that it is using this as a preemptive in itself is also a war crime, because even in international law of war, you are supposed to respond in a proportionate manner if you are being attacked. Actually, even this time, Israel itself admitted that there has been no provocation. Israel has been provoking again and again and again, and has been provoking the Palestinians in order to create a war with the Palestinians and in order to punish Palestinians again and again. So Palestinians have not done anything yet, and so Israel went and bombed and killed so many children, so many civilians, has destroyed again Gaza. This is apartheid. This is a crime against humanity.
The United States has time and again vowed to support Israel. This includes the U.S. President's latest trip to Israel, where he pledged full military support for Israel with regard to the Iron Dome, a new laser system, and other military support. And now regarding the latest round of attack against Gaza, the U.S. ambassador to the regime said Israel has a right to defend itself. That is a green light for Israel to continue with its rocket attacks. The U.K. Foreign Secretary also echoed similar remarks, adding that the kingdom stands by Israel.
Biden has continued support for Israel unconditionally. He repeated support for Israel and quote-unquote its security when it is not even threatened. It's the one that's threatening the security of the Palestinian people, including the children, women, elderly people, disabled, everybody. Israel is threatening the security. It's not the other way around. So for the United States to go around and for Joe Biden making so many promises during his campaign against Bush, against Trump, that he was going to roll back many of the aggressive actions of Trump, which were already before Trump, not really happily during Obama as well, and Joe Biden was his vice president. They were actually very problematic against the Palestinians. For Biden not to even reverse the steps, the aggressive steps that Trump has taken against the Palestinians, but to continue military aid, economic aid, collaboration with Israel, justification for Israel's attack on, it is giving a green light, and it is exactly the way we all understood it.
Those statements have, however, drawn criticism from the United Nations. The UN Special Reporter on the Occupied Palestinian Territories slammed the U.S. for the remarks and stated that Israel cannot claim that it is defending itself in this conflict. She also condemned the regime's attacks as illegal and irresponsible. Meanwhile, the office of the Palestinian president called this week's attack a dangerous escalation. The regime's attacks was also followed by a closure of two border crossings with the Gaza Strip. But Palestine has witnessed such acts of aggression from time and again, and the heaviest price is always paid by the civilians. The Gaza Strip has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007. That is 15 years of a blockade. Israel has also waged many wars against the Gaza Strip and killed scores of Palestinians, yet there's no mention of this, while Russia's war in Ukraine takes center stage on a daily basis.
A series of drills across six zones surrounding Chinese Taipei. Conventional missile firepower assault in the waters east of Taiwan. More than 100 warplanes, including fighters and bombers, as well as over 10 destroyers and frigates. These are the largest military drills that China has conducted perhaps ever, showing its awesome military might.
This level of force displayed in such a manner shows how angry China is at the U.S. and the U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit.
Interparliamentary.
Since 1949, that Taiwan is an integral part of China. And they see that as China has moved from being under the control of imperialist powers to becoming a strong, independent nation, that they intend to exercise sovereignty over all of their historical, geographical range, including Taiwan.
Ironically, the G7 group of countries and the High Representative of the European Union have now issued a statement condemning these exercises, claiming that they threaten the stability of the region. In this instance, the European side has now backed the U.S. when it comes to its stance against China. Is this another Ukraine conflict scenario playing out? China sees this as a provocation, since it is endorsing and encouraging pro-separatist and pro-independence forces on the island.
Chinese made their strikes, probably using our visit as an excuse. Let me close by saying this. The Chinese have tried to isolate Taiwan. They may try to keep Taiwan from visiting or participating in other places, but they will not isolate Taiwan by preventing us to travel there.
China has in the past viewed Chinese Taipei as part of its territory. It has also publicly stated that it may take it by force one day if necessary. This is where the U.S. and now Europe come in. Just like Ukraine, both are warning China against any thoughts of a takeover, which parallels the conflict in Ukraine.
The People's Liberation Army has now declared 7 restricted zones near Taiwan and say that they will extend a range of military exercises through Monday. These provocative actions are a significant escalation.
I think the issue of provoking China is this. The United States does not have as part of its sort of thinking that somebody is going to be our equal. We have in the Western Pacific this amazing amount of military. Well, China happens to be there. That's part of the world that they're in. And I think that as time goes on, and they have been very clear about this, that they're not prepared to cede American military hegemony to us in the Western Pacific much longer.
But China is not Ukraine if the military display of China is anything to go by. The U.S. provocations against China and Europe's support come at a dangerous time when the world economy is on the precipice. The U.S. anti-China stance and China's maneuvers are taking place along some of the world's busiest shipping routes. Let's not forget, the global supply of vital semiconductors and electronic equipment produced in East Asia are in this region. Additionally, more than 60% of global maritime trade and more than 22% of the total global trade passes through the South China Sea. Is the U.S. and its European allies willing to risk this?
The war in Ukraine has created massive political and geostrategic shifts in alliances at regional and international levels. The war has now brought back the specter of the Cold War to the global scene. Russia, which is at loggerheads with the United States and its Western allies, says the era of constructive cooperation between Russia and Western countries is irrevocably over. Moscow says the end of the partnership is regardless of the result of the war in Ukraine. Regardless of the duration and outcome of Russia's special military operation in Ukraine, we can already state now that the 30-year era of generally constructive, though not problematic, cooperation with the West is irrevocably over.
Well, in politics, nothing is definite and irreversible, as we well know. Certainly, the situation is deeply affected by the events and the stanch positions of either side, particularly the Western and the Russian side. So in the near future, which means in the forthcoming months, is not envisageable a reversal of the distancing that has been signaled by both Russia and the United States and Europe on the issue of Ukraine.
The Russian official added that the current crisis has provided a unique opportunity to get rid of, quote, residual illusions. He also added that Moscow will use the crisis to go beyond the paradigm of what he described as friendly absorption, which Moscow says has been produced over and over again since 1992. It refers to a climate in which dominant powers following the collapse of the Soviet Union promised Russia to accept it as a member of advanced Western developed nations. It's now a fact that the West and its allies are no longer the hegemon powers at the international stage. Following the war in Ukraine, the West imposed a raft of massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia in a bid to weaken Moscow or to potentially make its economy collapse. The sanctions have hurt Russia's economy, but did not trigger its collapse. On the contrary, Russia's oil and gas revenues have soared over the past few months.
The Western side, with its approach, is also imposing a set of rules which are based on its own interests, although they pretend these rules to be universal. The rest of the world is instead proposing to identify shared rules which may differ in the practice according to the latitude and the cultural experience of the different societies. So this is the existential clash between the two sides.
It's now Western citizens who are paying higher gas and energy prices. The crisis has indeed negatively affected European and North American nations and their economies. It's now widely believed that the US has failed to create a united global front against Russia. The asymmetry of interests and perspectives between Washington and Moscow is unlikely to change anytime soon.
On this, we have to add the fact that the manufacturing capacity of the world has moved from the West to the East, particularly to the Far East, which is Asia. And this weakens considerably the perspectives of the West in long-term confrontation with the rest of the world.
And the latest spat between the United States and China over Taiwan is likely to further strain the relations between the Western-led bloc and the emerging counter-hegemonic alliance. Under these circumstances, emerging powers like Iran, with its vast energy sources and rising military might, can play a pivotal role in the shifting balances between the East and the West.
Tensions are ratcheting up between the United States and China over U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan. Pelosi arrived in Taiwan late on Tuesday despite harsh warnings from China. Pelosi is known for her anti-China stance and is the highest elected U.S. official to visit the island since 1997. China is now furious over the visit and has warned of a harsh response.
Well, first of all, both countries, the United States and China, cannot afford to have a hot war now because November is coming up. In the United States, it's the midterm elections. Both Nancy Pelosi and Biden risk seeing their support slipping away. As for China, November is also coming up, signaling the National People's Congress, which is supposed to confirm the presidency's third term, as well as unveiling a new leadership lineup of the top six or seven leaders of the Standing Committee of the Politburo.
China has now threatened to carry out, quote, targeted military operations in response to the visit. The situation around Chinese Taipei is already tense. China has deployed military hardware there and is conducting massive large-scale drills. The exercises feature J-20 stealth fighter jets and test firing of conventional missiles. Chinese military officials say the military exercises are a, quote, a stern deterrence against the United States over Taiwan and a serious warning for supporters of Taiwan independence. This is while some believe the goal of these exercises is to prepare for the military fight with Taiwan. But some believe the visit has in fact put China in the difficult position of having to show a resolute response while avoiding a full-blown conflict.
China's military exercises have been planned in advance. So there is a live fire military exercises now going on quite near Taiwan, less than 100 miles. And then six zones, military exercise zones, have been identified surrounding the Taiwan island and with live fire military exercises in all the six regions, in effect blockading the Taiwan island for 3 days, just to show, just to teach Taiwan a lesson and to clear, send a clear signal that China's red line has truly been crossed.
Pelosi's visit to Taiwan has been condemned by China's allies, including Iran and Russia. Moscow says Russia backs China over the Taiwan issue, warning that the provocative trip would put the United States on a collision course with Beijing. Iran says the visit to Taiwan is a turning point in the already tense ties between China and the US and will have reverberations across the world. Iran has also expressed full support for the One China policy. The crisis dates back to the time when the People's Republic of China was created in 1949. After the Communist Party seized power in mainland China in 1949, the US refused to recognize it as a rightful government in China. Back then, the US decided to open its embassy in Taipei. In the 1970s, Washington and Beijing decided to normalize their ties. In 1979, the US formally recognized the communist-run People's Republic of China and cut ties with Taipei. This meant that the United States recognized the People's Republic of China as the only legal government of China. But following that, the US Congress passed the Taiwan Relations Act, which has underpinned the US policy towards Taiwan ever since. The act authorizes de facto diplomatic relations and allows the US government to provide weapons to Taiwan.
The unification of Taiwan is very high up on Beijing's agenda. In fact, President Xi Jinping has made it quite plain that the latest time frame for Taiwan unification is the 2049, which is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But the ideal solution is still peaceful unification. But peaceful unification comes up with the reality that most of the Taiwanese people do not want a unification. But neither do they want independence, because independence would affect their livelihood or threaten their security. All they want is to maintain the status quo forever. But again, this risks that Taiwan will be drifting further and further away from China. So I think that China is likely to adopt a policy in the same way as they China succeeded in having Hong Kong being united with the motherland.
The US is now the largest arms provider to Taiwan. The Taiwan crisis comes amid shifting geopolitical alliance. The Ukraine crisis has already weakened the hegemonic position of the United States and its allies. It now appears that Washington is trying to provoke another crisis in the East Asia region to reassert its hegemony.
It's night, dark and cold. I walk in the city alone in the crowd.
Islamic laws.
Every street, every store is filled with colors and smiles as before. I know clouds are hidden behind these faces. Is there anyone who has a sunny heart? I put on my headphones and play the song, which repeats the enchanting whisper. I say, why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of Islamic Laws. I'm your host, Mahdi, and we're joined by Sheikh Javid. Assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, brother, for accepting our invitation. Dear audience, in this program, we are going to try to give answer to some questions on Islamic laws regarding Muharram and the mourning ceremonies of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But first, let's listen to a short biography of Ayatollah Khamenei. Stay tuned.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Welcome back, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. I'm Mahdi and we are joined with Sheikh Javid. And we are going to answer to some questions regarding Muharram, of course, based on Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwas. Well, Sheikh, the question here is, what is the ruling in the matter of buying and selling on the 9th and 10th of Muharram, that is Tasu'a and Ashura?
Well, as stated by Supreme Leader, Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, Buying and selling are not haram in and of themselves. You know, it is permissible to buy something or to sell something that is that people need to buy, you know.
On Ashura.
On the 9th or 10th of Muharram, which is, of course, the 10th day of Muharram, it coincides or with the Ashura, or the day of Ashura, of course. So, but His Eminence does say or state that it is advisable that one attends the mourning ceremonies, the religious gatherings, which are commemorative gatherings, of course. And it's also advisable that he does not deprive himself of the magnificent reward promised for these mornings, of course. So to make it short, I would say that buying and selling are permissible in and of itself, as long as it's not considered to be a kind of disregard for Muharram. But of course, if it's considered to be a kind of disregard or a kind of insult to the event of Ashura, it's not permissible, because we do know that if a practice is considered a kind of disregard or disrespectful, if it is considered disrespectful in common view, of course, then it is not permissible. But of course, generally speaking, buying, selling are permissible, even if it is on the day of Ashura or on the 9th of Ashura or Muharram.
Well, the next question is, in commemorating the martyrdom of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the 10th day of Muharram, that is Ashura, some people hit themselves or walk barefooted on fire. Such actions defame Shiism and put it in a bad light, if not undermine it. They cause bodily and spiritual harms on those doing it as well. What is Ayatollah Khamenei's fatwa on this matter?
That's a good question. As you rightly mentioned, such actions as you mentioned, for example, knives to hit oneself and also walking barefooted on fire, defame Shiism and also undermine the position of Shiism in the international level or in the global arena. And not to mention the fact that, you know, hitting yourself with a knife or with a machete or a sword will definitely leave a bodily harm on you. And also it has spiritual harms for the person who practices this kind of, self-flagellation. Mm-hmm. You know, it has a long impact, and probably it may kind of be deadly as well, because I have seen myself in some countries where I have been to, I've seen Shia Muslims practicing tatbir. And of course, the religious authorities, including Ayatollah Khamenei, are strongly opposed to tatbir or to qamazani. Of course, these are the common words used by Muslims across the world. So tatbir is not permissible according to His Eminence, because it's not considered to be a manifestation of azadari or a manifestation of mourning for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn alayhi salatu wassalam. And let's also look at, for example, if you look at some Shia Muslims walking barefooted on fire, what does it actually mean? Does it make any sense, you know, walking on fire? As some Muslims in the Indian subcontinent and even maybe in Pakistan practice this, that's not azadari. No one considers walking on fire as an action or as a manifestation of azadari. And of course, instead of these people walking on fire, why not they read books to get to know something about the concept of azadari, the philosophy of mourning for Abu Abdullah al-Husayn.
The philosophy of uprising of Imam al-Husayn.
Yeah, that's it. And that's the main goal of azadari. We need to learn lessons. There are some important lessons which we need to take from this event. Of course, when we talk about the event of Ashura or the Marti or Muharram is a school where everyone, young men and women, young and old, can attend this school, can join this school and take part in the classes that are taught by Imam Hussein himself in the first place. Of course, these lessons are for everyone, and of course, mm-hmm. everyone should take a lesson from these events. Imam Hussein, the concept of Zardari is not about only wearing black clothes and also, you know, expressing emotions. There is rationality behind it. Okay?
It's a part of the issue, actually. Yeah,
it is. I'm saying it's not only about it, you know. Yeah. Wearing black is good, of course. Expressing grief is highly recommended. And also to weep for the sufferings of Imam Hussein alayhi wasallam is highly recommended. And the person who weeps and cries, of course, will be rewarded for weeping and for showing sympathy with the Ahlul Bayt of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him. But the lessons that we can, why did Imam Hussein alayhi wasallam stand up? He stood up for justice. He stood up to revive the religion of his grandfather, and he stood up to revive the religion of his father and grandfather. And we also, at this time around, we have the same duty. We have to follow the same goal and try to assimilate ourselves with Imam Hussein alayhi wasallam, and try to do not only learn lessons, but also we should stand up for justice and practice what is just.
Thank you for your nice answer, dear brother Sheikh Javid. Dear audience, let's take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
I work in the night with millions of stars. Your eyes pull me to you. Who are you? I walk in the day with millions of angels. I see you in all these faces. Who are you? One step I fade away, the next step I'm born again. You're flowing in my veins. Who are you? Wherever I get tired, you call me from far and near. Whenever I get thirsty, you start to melt and say to me,
welcome back to your audience of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Islamic Laws by me, Mahdi, and our dear expert, Sheikh Javid. He's going to answer our questions regarding Muharram, of course, according to the fatwas of Ayatollah Khamenei. Dear Sheikh, we've got another question, that is, what is the Shari'i criterion in determining physical or psychological damage, of course, when doing mourning ceremonies of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam?
The criterion is noticeable and considerable harm judged by the common sense. You know, a common sense, or what we call urf or common view, actually tells us as to whether a damage or harm is considerable or not. Mm-hmm. If we have doubt about a damage inflicted on us during Muharram, we need to turn to the custom or to the common view and ask whether it is considered to be considerable or not. In the event that it is considered to be considerable and noticeable or remarkable, of course, we have to stop there. We should not exceed the limits. Uh-huh. When, for example, beating our chest or doing something. Of course, as I said, a supreme leader has strictly forbidden the practice of tatbir or qamazani or whatever they call it, because in some Indian, for example, Muslims, they use it, they call the term tatbir as talwarzani, and we, the Shia Muslims in Iran, of course, call it qamazani. The Arabs, they use the word tatbir. No matter what the word is, mm-hmm. and no matter what expression we use to refer to this practice, tatbir has been forbidden by His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, and it's not only the supreme leader Ayatollah Khamenei, but also many other religious authorities in this time around who forbid the practice of tatbir, because it doesn't make any sense, and it's not considered in expression of azadari. And it is not considered an expression of azadari, but it also damages
the image of Islam
and destroys the reputation of the Shia Islam as a peace-loving religion. Self-flagellation or tatbir is a violent practice that's not condoned by Islam, and that's not permitted by the religious authorities and also by the infallible imams. So I wish we could have talked a lot, but you know, we have run out of time.
Brother. Thank you, dear brother Sheikh Jawid, for your nice answers, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio, for staying with us. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Until our next episode, fi aman Allah and goodbye.
Every breath that you did take, every step that you would make, purpose and guidance it gave, mankind's heart it reawaked. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Many people did leave the first teachings received. Hussein planned to retrieve loss of faith he perceived. Guide, you would be in place of Rasul to restore the sacred bridge. Light, you would radiate in the dark and continue the message. When you passed through arid sand, met foreigners of new lands.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. We express our condolences on the arrival of the month of Muharram and the martyrdom anniversary of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javedan. Stay tuned. Our deeds become more important during the month of Muharram. For instance, if we take care of our eyes by not committing sins, we may shed more tears in this month. Or we have to be more careful about the food that we eat. We are not allowed to eat anything Anyway, the effects of our good deeds are shown in our broken hearts and sad souls for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in the month of Muharram.
Karbala! As I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala!